Now, when we think of the built world, buildings, they're solid, weighty, permanent. This, however, is not reality. The life of buildings is fleeting, and the life of buildings is getting shorter. Here's a Blueprint for Living fun fact. As a US Census report, it recently found, this is extraordinary, the average life of a residential building in the US, 32 years. Now, in Australia, it's about the same. That then raises the question of what gets knocked over, what gets preserved, what's worthy of preservation. Really interesting set of issues. And Kate Wagner is going to help us pick through them. She's an architecture critic, creator of the rather viral blog McMansion Hell. She's thought long and hard about these questions and joins us via Skype from the US. Kate, welcome.
Thank you.
There feels like an inherent paradox in this, that something so solid should be so short-lived.
I agree. I think most people conceive of buildings as being this permanent thing. I mean, we call it a mortgage for a reason, meaning until death. But the reality is that most buildings, especially those built in the last, quarter century or so, have been pretty much disposable for several reasons. There's things in the laws, there's things in preservation, all kinds of interesting reasons why those 32 years are so short.
And yet surely it's a function of modernity to some extent. I mean, we live and they are all around us, buildings which have endured for centuries, and once upon a time that was the intention.
I mean, if you think about it, there's a certain standard for buildings, right? The average house, say, in America or Australia has a shelf life of 32 years, right? I mean, that's long enough for you to, have your kids raise them and then grow old. But for things, for example, like cultural institutions, like museums or concert halls, those kinds of things that are supposed to be permanent bulwarks of culture, they're built and meant to be permanent. But even then, as I've discovered, there are exceptions. So I think what's interesting, as a function of modernity, I think that's certainly true. I think that there is a kind of ethos of consumption that has been prevalent in what we talk about, like, for example, food or kitchens or bathrooms or whatever, this aesthetics of waste, right? This consumption of there's conspicuous consumption. But what's interesting is that doesn't necessarily sort of translate to buildings in a way. And so you find these shocking things that, 32 years is an example of, or the fact that they're going to tear down a skyscraper in New York City that was built in the 1960s and recently remodeled for millions of dollars. And it just doesn't vibe with what our understandings of what buildings are, what they do, and what they should be. And that's a really interesting dichotomy there that I think is absolutely a function of modernity, but even more so kind of this culture of disposable consumption.
I feel slightly out of place in this. I live in a house in a Melbourne in Australia, which was built in the mid-1880s. And it's surrounded by a suburb, which is a similar vintage. So there are sort of anomalous zones in our cities, in our towns, which buck this trend.
I agree. I'm currently sitting in an apartment that was built in 1910. But the truth is about buildings, that is a kind of inconvenient truth, is that all buildings need maintenance. And some buildings are made more durable than others. That's certainly true. Like, for example, the entirety of the building that I'm sitting in is made of brick. Like, the walls are load-bearing and the masonry is fine. The quality is fine. And it's just not the same of a house that's been built with framing, the kind of current framing style for like McMansion, where it has all these weaknesses because the complexity is so great that makes it sort of susceptible to the elements. And I recently wrote about this in an article for Curved, is that we designed our houses and buildings around the change in our possessions, which change the most rapidly. For example, for services, when the plumbing needs to be changed, which happens periodically in a house's lifetime, we have designed these houses with completely open floor plans where services have to be routed all kinds of arcane and illogical ways in order to achieve this architectural effect. And so when it comes time to, if you have a leak, for example, in your plumbing in the wall or something, it becomes a lot more difficult to fix it than if you had several walls and you could possibly reroute it somewhere, or there's just no flexibility. So I definitely think that there has been changes in the development of buildings and materials and what have you. I think that there's certainly trends that we've built for the now instead of for tomorrow.
I mean, there's also a shift, I think, in where the building structures sits in the sort of the hierarchy of human endeavor. It's become a much easier thing and a much more playful thing. It's not that thing that we have to sort of put everything into and therefore it has to survive forever. It's something which can be happily impermanent.
I think that's true too, and that's a double-edged sword. I think that there's something to be said for understanding buildings as being spontaneous and impermanent and transient and always changing. And I think that helps us deal with changes because the built environment is always changing. It never stops changing. Mm. And I think that that's something that people just kind of forget because buildings are the backdrop of everyday life. And you go day after day after day and see the same thing on the same street and suddenly something is gone or something new is there and it becomes a big deal because it's just a disruption in our sort of pattern recognition. But I also think that to some extent, it's sad, too. I think that because buildings are the backdrop of everyday life, we become attached to them in a way that is more emotional and more they build up a part of our own personal histories, our own personal narratives. They're our first job. We worked at Toys R Us, for example, which is now sort of like in this weird post-bankruptcy state. Or we had our wedding in a Ramada Inn that's now been torn down or something. It's one of those things where it's like if the places that are keystone markers in our progression as human beings are being lost. And what was sad was that, you know, preservation, historic preservation, considers only like the top echelon of buildings, right?
Yep.
Buildings by famous architects or backdrops of like important events. But for these everyday buildings that make up the majority of everyday life, especially suburban life or modern life, they kind of get left by the wayside and are treated on the whole as disposable. And it's just a factor of you know, production, but also it's sad too. It's nuanced. It's not just one or the other.
Which raises an interesting question. I mean, well, a series of questions around what we choose to protect, what we choose to preserve, and what those choices say about, the preservation of certain tastes or the preservation of certain sort of elite senses of what cities and buildings should be and comprise.
I think that's what's interesting. I compared like Toys R Us, right? These things that like people have documented through these photographs and what have you as being important in their lives, but all are precarious. But we understand that they're precarious. But things like a house designed by one of the most important mid-century female architects in New York City, a skyscraper that's been recently redone, is now also under threat. It just seems the irony there is that even elite buildings are endangered now. But preservation, it kind of goes against what we conceive of being preservation or what preservation projects itself to be, which is that the criteria that decides whether or not a building is worth saving is multiple and it differs across countries. Mm. And I talked about this a little, but all of that is really informed as a project of sort of moneyed institutions like museums, cultural centers, nonprofits, universities, governments, people who have the power and money to play an outside role in shaping architectural history. So we tend to save buildings for important things happen, like Ford's Theater, where Lincoln got shot, for example. Or we tend to save buildings that were built by Frank Lloyd Wright, for example. But even a Frank Lloyd Wright building got torn down last year. We tend to save buildings that are important for the progression of certain historical events. Like we'll save the laboratories of where a famous scientific discovery was found. But these are all kind of considered in this way, this sort of like understanding of history isn't a progression of events by great people, whereas history in reality it encompasses everything. It's everyday life. And that's what I think is sad.
So, and that leads to pockets of reaction against that sort of conventional sense of what ought to be preserved. But I'd like you to talk us through the Kmart group, which is a really interesting resistance to that sort of conventional notion of preservability.
I've been fascinated with these groups online, these groups on Flickr, which is a photo sharing website, for years. I mean, since I was in high school, I've been obsessed with this. So the Kmart group, this is going to sound ridiculous, but it's a photo sharing group that has amassed 25,000 photographs of Kmart, which is a struggling American discount store that's owned by Sears, which just went into bankruptcy. So the future of Kmart is even more dire. So, I mean, the point of the group is not exactly to take great photos. Most of them are like shaky, like obviously taken in a car with a cell phone. But it's really to document a what I think is a slow extinction of something that was once a brick and mortar giant. To give you an example of the decay of Kmart, in 2000, which was the peak of Kmart, there were 2,171 U.S. stores. Only 365 survive. That's just decimation. So the Kmart group has pretty much built these autonomous people from all across the country have built this group of photos that is probably the most complete visual archive of the store, probably exceeding that of Kmart's own archives. I mean, it has everything from scans of old flyers, and the people will take pictures every week showing how the display cases moves. It is scientific almost, the amount of dedication that is put in, and it's just amateurs. It's just amateur dedication. They don't follow the rules of actual like archiving standards or anything like that. These are just people picking and putting together histories of something that mattered to them. So it's definitely fascinating, just from a sociological standpoint, from an architectural standpoint, from a historical standpoint.
It's a really interesting reclamation of you know, the emotional significance of a built environment in our lives, and a statement that that's something worthy of preservation as well.
I think so. I think that preservation goes beyond just like turning houses into house museums, which is kind of what we think of it as being. Like, oh, we saved this old building and you can go tour it twice a year or something. And it's just like everything is like meticulously maintained, just like a photograph or something. And of course, preservationists, they debate this amongst themselves. Mm. It's not like this is a group of stuffy people. This is a very hotly contested ethos of historical, you know, preservation or saving history. What constitutes history? It's always been debated.
It raises the question, yes, though, of what we might do with a hoard of preserved Kmarts.
I don't think the goal is necessarily to preserve the Kmarts. I think it's they know the people who the thing is that the people who document these Kmarts and they or other retail stores or things like old signs or motels or postcards or any of these groups which have amassed each thousands and thousands and thousands of photographs. The point is to document and to have some record of it. Mm. I don't think anyone wants to have like a perfectly preserved Kmart museum. I don't think that's necessarily the goal, and no one has the money for that either. I think it's more to just have something, because these people know, and we all know as we drive and the built environment changes as we go along, that the loss is inevitable. And it's because people are afraid of that loss. They're afraid that this thing that they know that is a part of their life is going to disappear. And someone has got, it's the instinct to preserve, it's the instinct to document. Somebody has got to make sure that there is a record of this, that this place existed, that there were people who cared about it. Because you could just, if people feel like they're just wiped off the face of the planet. And it's the same reason why people keep diaries. It's the same reason why people keep photo albums. It just kind of extends more to the public realm than more sort of internally. But I think it's a very human thing to do. And I think it's a very meaningful way of coping with loss.
Our quest for well, significance and attachment and senses of permanence, it's a complex world. Kate, thank you for walking us through some of that.
Thank you.
Kate Wagner, she's an architecture critic. She's the creator of McMansion Hell. It's a very viral bloggy space. Blueprint here on RN.